Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us on the Wise Women Media, the radio show. We broadcast every Friday night at 10 o'clock. That's Eastern Standard Time. You can find us online at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. And also on that blog, you'll find links to our social networks, ways to contact us if you feel so inclined and you want to keep us on the air and help us sustain this show so you can hear it every week. Hit us up at the GoFundMe link there, and no amount is too small to help out. We want to give a shout-out to our sponsors, which are also listed there, in particular Here Be Monsters on Blog Talk Radio, that so we can do our show. And we are on. We also, in addition to our Twitter, and our Facebook group and Facebook page, we now also are on Tumblr. So if you are on Tumblr, head over to wisewomenmedia.tumblr.com. And always feel free to connect with us and give us feedback on the show, or you can suggest guests for future shows. So I want to bring our guest on the line, Philan. Janet C. Philan is an independent author, investigative reporter, journalist. She's done poetry. She has been super active on a number of... We could actually probably do a three-hour show, but we are slotted to do 1 hour tonight. I'm going to bring her on immediately. Oh, wanted to give you all the name of the song before we start. That was Chrissy Hynde and the Pretenders with Angel of the Morning. So, Janet, are you on the line with me?
Yes, I am, Anita. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, well, great. Thanks for being on. I'm so honored that, I mean, I've just been looking at some of the writings you've done, and you've really remained busy. I think I had you on, maybe the last time was about a year and a half ago, or maybe longer, and you're
maybe
just
longer.
As busy and out there, and there's just so many issues that you're covering. So why don't we start with how you started writing and what led you to write this particular book, which for those of you that haven't looked at the complete show description, the book is called Exile. So tell us a little bit about the book.
Yes, first of all, I do want to correct you. My last name is pronounced Phelan. It's an Irish Catholic name. And that's okay. Everybody is mispronouncing it, and I just want to kind of assert that it is pronounced Phelan. I'm actually very proud of the name. I got it from my father. My father was an investigative reporter on the national scene and started off very humble beginnings as a cub reporter at the Alton Evening Telegraph, and then ended up as investigative reporter for the Saturday Evening Post, and his first book made the cover of Time magazine in 1976. So you ask about, you know, my interest in writing and so forth, my interest in investigative reporting, and it really did come, you know, directly from my father, who I write about him a bit in the book as well, but the book itself, Exile, is the story of why I fled the U.S. And I do consider myself in exile at this point in time. I know that, you know, there are some people out there who kind of may have heard this and may know, like, well, what is really that all about? And I felt that given the severity of the issues that compelled me to flee my country, given the implications of the issues, given, you know, what happened and what it means, that it was really time to come forward about all this. So the book is entitled Exile and was just published about a month or so ago and is available right now only on thebookpatch.com.
I think it's so important that, I mean, I think the timing is serendipitous because, you know, we've had the whole story about Snowden, and now they're talking about Assange again coming out of the embassy, but nobody's really giving him safe passage. So I heard a little bit about that on the news today. So, you know, people need to know that these stories are happening to a lot of people in many different places. Only a few reach the mainstream media and are expounded on. So tell us a little bit about how that happened to you, how you ended up leaving the United States.
Right. I left essentially under duress, and I left under grave threat and duress. And the situation that evolved is a somewhat complex situation, and it began in the year 2000 when I was approached by a man named Jack Smith. Turns out not his real name, but it's the name he's been using now for some years. He still lives in West Hollywood. I was approached by him socially. I ended up lured into a romantic relationship with him. He did not at any point disclose to me that he was a federal agent, nor did he disclose that I was his assignment. And he approached me with a I guess, a mission in mind, and the mission was quite deadly. And the book goes into, in some detail, how I was approached by Smith, what began to happen. You know, when I was ended, I ended up living with him for a while at his condo in West Hollywood, and things began to happen that were simply off the charts in terms of what I certainly expected, you know, what America is about, you know, laws, legal systems, and so forth. I want to go into a little bit about my mother, because this Jack Smith's mission was apparently a twofer, and and things happened to my mother. And the first things that started to happen started to happen to both of us, kind of you know, in different ways right away. I do go into in the book a little bit how I was approached in the fall of 2000. Initially, I wasn't really following up too much with Jack Smith, and shortly thereafter, within a couple of months, I was on my way home late at night. I was, I don't know, visiting friends, and I was going through Cherry Park in Long Beach, and I was broadsided by a car, which it was a pretty bad accident. I went into the windshield, my car was smashed up, and the other car just took off into the night. And the police were called by Good Samaritans, who kind of moved my car out of the intersection because it was not even drivable at that point. And the police showed up, and they came over. They looked at the car. They asked for my identification. At that point, I was bleeding, unable to get out of the car. As it turns out, I had a concussion. Well, the police came back to the car and said, well, this was your fault. You know, we've checked at the tire treads, and this was all your fault. And they piled into the police car and took off and left me around midnight sitting in a smashed-up car with blood on my face. So that was, that. You know, things began to happen along those lines where the normal protections that are afforded U.S. citizens, I mean, you get in an accident, the least that's going to happen is an ambulance is going to come or a paramedic or something. There began to be what I term systemic pullout. And the book goes into these details. At that point, I hadn't even met Jack Smith. I did find out later through some careless notations I found in a notebook of his that he had, before he ever made the outreach to me, he was camped out in a motel about a block away from my house in Long Beach, about 6 months before he made, you know, the first outreach. So I was being stalked by a federal agent who was not
rogue. Yeah, you were
not
being observed, and your comings and goings were being probably recorded and documented. And
well, whatever
so
he was doing, whatever, yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, whatever he was doing, you know, he was certainly checking something out. So so I began to have, you know, these peculiar things happen, and before I actually met Smith, and I finally did meet him in January. We got together in January of 2001. Socially, we went out to dinner, and you know, it began. He began to, you know, act in a courting manner, and he was very successful at it. I was at that point 48 years old. I was divorced. I was not working. I had, you know, excellent journalism training and a reasonable resume, but I had been suffering from some medical conditions and was not working. My father had passed. My powerful, well-connected father had passed away in 97. And my mother, who had been a clinical psychologist all of her career at a PhD, had only recently retired, maybe a year or so before Jack Smith showed up. And so I am being wined and dined by the federal agent, and I go into quite a bit of detail about the courtship. At some point, I, of necessity, in the spring of 2001, after we've been seeing each other rather steadily for a few months, I move in with him out of necessity. Very strangely, my landlady is calling me, insisting I move out, not giving a reason, really leaning on me. I'm looking as hard as I can for another place to live. And strangely, I can't get a bite. I can't even get a call back. I mean, the whole situation was becoming, you know, her calling and yelling and telling me to leave. And, you know, I had no idea what was going on. I know that her husband had recently died, and I thought maybe she was having some sort of nervous breakdown. But, you know, you have to leave, you have to leave. So finally, I call my new boyfriend. I said, look, I've got to get out of here. Could I come stay at your place for a while? So as a friend who used to work for the CIA commented when she heard this part of the story, she goes, oh, yeah, they parked you with them. So I did move in with him, and almost immediately there was a lot of voiced concern about my mother. My mother had, as I said, you know, had been very, very well educated, had a really wonderful long career working as a psychologist, and she had fallen prey to a financial check forgery scam, actually, as it turns out by my sister. So there were concerns like, what's going to happen with the finances? And Jack's really pressuring me. You know, what are you going to do about this? And don't know what to do. And I get steered by Jack into certain law offices of an attorney named J. David Horsfall, who practices in Redlands. And to make a long story short, my mother slept with an adult guardianship.
Wow.
Yeah. The meeting with Horsfall was rife with misinformation, lies. We you know, I was under the impression that we were looking for a bookkeeper who'd kind of take a look at the family finances, and before I know it, this guardianship is in place. For those who don't know how dangerous, perilous, really, adult guardianships can be, I'd like to just take a minute or so to talk about what the implications of a guardianship might be. Because upon the initiation of an adult guardianship, the ward of the alleged incapacitated person loses almost all of their rights. They lose all access to their property and their assets. They can't even hire an attorney to contest the guardianship. So you go from being a fully vested U.S. citizen to a legal zero.
Right.
Essentially. Right. So I didn't even know what a guardianship was at this point. I didn't know. You know, I was just trying to help my mother, you know, figure out where all the money was going, and thought maybe a bookkeeper would help, you know. So
at this point, you didn't consider yourself, or you didn't have any kind of suspicion that you were a targeted individual. You were just going through your life trying to solve these problems that, of course, everybody has. But this executorship over your mother, didn't you feel at the time that, wow, this is really extreme?
Well, you know, like I said, I didn't at first know what it was. And as I detail in the narrative in the book, my mother's been under the guardianship for about a month. I still don't really understand what this is all about. And I call over to speak with her, as I did every day. She was living in Riverside County, which was about 90 miles away from where I was living with Jack Smith. And I call every day, and I reach a stranger. And I say, hey, you know, who is this? Is my mom there? And the stranger says, you can't talk to your mom, and hangs up. I go, what the heck? So I call back, and the stranger says, oh, you can't talk to your mom anymore, and hangs up. I mean, you know, like, who is this person? So I kept calling all day until I finally was able to reach my mother, who said, oh, yeah, it's like the guardian put this woman in the house. You know, she's like watchdogging the phone. It was so, you know, it seemed strange to have someone else living in the house. You know, my mother did not have Alzheimer's. My mother was getting older and certainly, you know, had been victimized by this financial exploitation by my sister, but, you know, it seemed suddenly like things were beginning to go a little haywire, and they continued to get more haywire when I would come to visit, and I came very often to visit my mother. The caregiver would let the guardian know. Guardian was Melody Scott, and Melody Scott would call the police on me. You know, it began to get really, I remember at one point I was on the way to see my mother, and I called the police prophylactically first. I said, do I or do I not have a right to see my own mother? And the police said, well, if she wants to see you, there's no problem. And I walked into the house, and the caregiver starts screaming at me, you know, get out. And I just, you know, walked right past her, and she had some sort of, like, fit and just went running out, you know, in the street into the night yelling. I mean, it was, you know, drama. So obviously, you know, there was an attempt to keep me away from my mother. And in June of 2002, it became very clear why. My mother at that point had been under the guardianship for a few months. And she wasn't doing very well. She seemed to be getting sort of weak and not feeling so good. And then I call her on one Monday, and she says, I'm very ill, and no one is paying attention to me. At this point, there was the caregiver in the house being paid by the guardian, and my sister was also being paid by the guardian to, quote-unquote, take care of my mother. So this is, you know, someone says that they're ill and no one's paying any attention. This is rather alarming. So I sped to Temecula to find my mother in terrible situation. She could hardly walk. She was kind of going almost in and out of consciousness. It was terrifying. So after some, you know, consultation, I got her into the car and took her to an emergency room. And to make this part of the story brief, because I have to talk about a little bit about what happened as a result of this hospitalization of my mother's. As a result of the hospitalization, initially, she was admitted, and it was determined that her heart was failing, and she was taken into surgery and given a pacemaker. I go back to the family house, and on a hunch, I check my mother's pill bottles. My mother had been a heart patient and was taking a heart medicine, and there were two nearly full undispensed bottles of heart medicine. Nobody had bothered to give my mother her heart medicine for a couple of months. There may have been some other things going on there as well that may have produced, you know, this crisis in her heart. But nevertheless, at that point, I called the police. I figured this is at least criminal negligence. Police came, took a report. And in a couple of days, I found out that the guardian, Melody Scott, had gone to court and declared to the court that I had unnecessarily transported my mother to the hospital, thereby causing her grave emotional distress, and I needed to be restrained from my mother. Now, that hearing went through without notification. There's no proof of service that, you know, I was ever notified that a TRO was happening. So I was temporarily restrained from my mother. The restraining order came to hearing, on the permanency on August 1st of 2002. And it's important that I discuss this, because when I started off in the beginning talking about systemic pullout, you know, revocation of sort of normal activities around a person, at this point it became stunningly clear to me that neither my mother nor I had any rights whatsoever. So on August 1st of 2002, I go to the court. I am documented, and the documentation is supplied in the book. I'm documented as being in court when court opens and when court closes, and I my restraining order is never called to hearing, and I am permanently restrained from my mother without a hearing. And this is also documented in the book. So very shortly thereafter, the same judge who violated the due process clause of the United States Constitution and restrained me without hearing what I had to say. And, of course, what I had to say was very simple. My mother had a pacemaker inserted. You know, the medical records will show this. Apparently, the judge didn't want to hear this. So, you know, there went my relationship with my mother. Shortly thereafter, I'm hit with a second restraining order, also documented in the book, in which I am restrained from contacting the police, the Department of Justice, Adult Protective Services, also peculiarly the CIA, not that I'd ever contacted the CIA to my knowledge, and you know, I'm permanently restrained from contacting these agencies and more. I know of no law which allows a judge to deprive a United States citizen of the right to call the police. Nevertheless, that's what I got hit with. So, and at that point, my mother has been virtually disappeared.
Yeah, that's just bizarre. It's like the rule of law is just totally disregarded. So what happened? I mean, what happened at that point? Where did they move her from the hospital to another location, or?
She was moved around. Yes, and at there's some discussion, you know, in the book about, you know, some preliminary attempts of mine to see her and what happened and so forth. But then she's moved again. I have no idea where she's, or even if she's alive. So at that point, and we're now in October of 2002, I become totally dedicated to getting some sort of resolution to what's happening to my mother. And I am spending, I break up with Jack Smith. That is of necessity because he committed an act of violence against my person, which forced me, you know, I had no choice at that point in time.
Right.
And the his reasons for doing that also became clear. As soon as I moved out of his place and back into a little place in Long Beach, some very disturbing things started to happen. And it became very clear to me that I was like living, I was radioactive in a sense. My house started to burn down while I slept. There was an incident where I had been in Riverside going to court trying to do something about what was happening to my mother. I was gone for a couple of days. I come back, and as I'm walking back towards my cottage, which was behind a front house where the landlady lived, I hear the landlady say, "Oh, she's here. Quick, call the police." Now, lucky for me, I heard that because I walk back into my cottage. I open the door, and my cottage has been tossed. Now, most people, they come home and they find out that, you know, somebody's tossed, you know, somebody's been in their house and ransacked it. They're going to call the police. But I'm thinking, wait a minute, the police are already coming? So I'm trying to figure out what's going on, and I'm looking around, like, really carefully, and there are all these pink pills all over my floor. Not my pink pills. And I immediately realized, I'm going to get busted. I'm going to get busted for possession of something, and I don't even know what this is. So I moved very quickly. I pulled the blinds. I, you know, shut the windows, pulled all the blinds, made sure that the cottage could not be viewed from outside, and I started scooping and flushing and scooping, and it took about 6 or 7 minutes, and the knock comes on the door. You know, the police are there, open up, and I froze. I mean, I didn't even breathe. They couldn't see in. They didn't see in. And I just sort of was there pressed against the wall, unbreathing, until I heard the footsteps retreat. And at that point, I hear the landlady a couple minutes later. She's walking in the garden with her roommate, husband, father. I could never figure out what he was, actually. It was a very nebulous relationship. She said, well, I think it went pretty well. I mean, they took the report. Sooner or later, they'll get her, right? So,
Oh, my God.
So
whatever was going on, you were being accused of using drugs or whatever with drugs.
There was an attempt. There was an attempt made, definitely, to create the illusion of this. Those who know me know I don't smoke. I might have a beer on New Year's Eve, but I'm really not even interested in alcohol, and I don't do drugs. I'm, as far as that scenario goes, I'm pretty much a Girl Scout. So, you know, it was a very, they were reaching, okay? They were really reaching, you know, in terms of trying to create this scenario. So at this point in time, as I'd mentioned, starting in October, I am totally focused on doing something about what's happened to my mother. I'm spending my days calling lawyers. I'm calling civil rights agencies. I'm calling Jewish organizations. My mother is Jewish, and therefore I am Jewish. My father was not. I wasn't really brought up Jewish, but nevertheless, that is, you know, my part of my bloodline or whatever you want to call it. I'm calling media. I'm calling the ACLU. I'm calling everybody, right? And everything gets just pushed aside in my life because this woman, who was really one of the most remarkable, brilliant, loving people that I was so lucky to have been, you know, born into that family. And she, these terrible things are happening to her. And my life just narrows down to this point of concern, you know, what to do about this. And on January 3rd of 2003, after some further disturbing sorts of events, you know, where I'm obviously getting now, you know, levels of attention that I can't even begin to comprehend. On January 3rd of 2003, I was attacked with lethal intent by the Long Beach Police Department, officers of the Long Beach Police Department. And I was in the hospital. I was in a coma for a couple of days. So I woke up. I woke up from the coma, which I'm not sure I was intended or expected to do. Having woken up, I woke up on a heart monitor. I had some difficulty getting out of the hospital. I mean, the whole situation was Kafka-esque.
Right.
But from that, Kafka-esque beyond. And I go into quite a bit of detail in the book as to the sorts of things that were happening. So from that point on, I embarked on an entirely new life. It didn't get better. It didn't. I thought, well, okay, they took their best shot. You know, I'm certainly not going to ever get within 10 miles of a police officer again. Things are going to be, you know, things are going to begin to normalize, and things got less and less normal. And I ended up leaving the country in 2003 and made a decision at the point of realizing that whosoever radar I had gotten on, that it was not confined within the borders of the U.S. And so I made a decision to come back to my country and to use my journalism skills, whatever small skills, abilities I have, to throw my hat into the ring and to try to make a difference. My mother, of course, ended up dead. I ended up having really, I mean, to a degree, it's a bit like the perils of Pauline, some of the things that happened. I try to keep the drama, you know, to the minimum, but to make clear that to some degree things never normalized, and on some levels things just continued you know, and I continue to walk through them like I walked through that entrapment attempt with the pills in my house. There began to be other attempts at legal entrapment. I mean, the whole situation became almost unbelievable. I left the country permanently in 2008. At that point, I had moved to Southern Oregon. I was working at a newspaper that's more or less in the freedom movement, and I had started broadcasting. I had two radio shows. One was on KSKQ, which was the Pacifica affiliate in Ashland,
right.
And then I got a national show on Republic Broadcasting Network. So I was doing, you know, I was in my salad days, I guess it's called. You know, I was working at the newspaper, doing two radio shows. I mean, it was working, it was cooking, and there began to be accelerated police misconduct again. And after a situation evolved with Medford Police, which I not only report on but also was able to document, I was able to get documents showing that the police were falsifying records in order to launch another attempt at arrest. At that point, I threw in the cards and I left. So what does this all mean?
I think it's important for the listeners to know what kind of topics were you covering as far as media on the radio, and maybe the listeners don't understand why you became a targeted person and why these things were happening to you. And as a person who was targeted at one time myself, I certainly understand this, but then again, most people that you talk to about these instances, well, number one, their first impression is to say, oh, it's all coincidence, you know, maybe it was your imagination. But I'm thinking there's more cognitive dissonance going on than we can even imagine. But we who have been through it, certainly it's very real to us. So if you could let the listeners know, what were you writing about, and what kind of shows, what was the topic matter?
Right. Well, I have to really, divide that question into two parts. The part before Jack Smith showed up, and then because I believe, you know, having survived the police assault and, you know, just and made the decision to come back and do what I could to, you know, bring truth to light, I think that the situation changed at that point in time. So just to briefly say, the kinds of stories I was covering when, you know, in 2008 when I was up in Oregon had to do with biological weapons, the U.S. having violated the international treaty having to do with biological weapons. Actually, at one point in the narrative, and this is actually now in 2011, I traveled to Geneva, Switzerland, and was able to present to the United Nations and provide them the evidence that the United States, which is, you know, has ratified and signed the Biological Weapons Convention, has massively violated the convention. And,
oh, yeah.
So you know, there was this focal point. There's also been a focal point in my work on how the legal system has altered enormously since the events of September 11th, and how, you know, the legal system is, in a sense, been weaponized and is being used against targeted demographic groups. So those have been, you know, a couple of the focal points. I also was able to break a story last year having to do with the gas attack in Syria. There were some hacked emails that surfaced, which heavily indicted U.S. forces for having conjured up the entire gas attack in order to provide a reason, a raison d'etre, to invade Syria. I've covered a lot of different issues. But when Jack Smith showed up in my life back in 2000, I do not believe There's no reason to believe that there was any concern on the part of any intelligence agency that I constituted any kind of a threat whatsoever. And this goes to the heart of what I, the impetus behind my writing the book, because I have come to the conclusion that our government is actually focusing on attacking the vulnerable, on attacking the weak, the vulnerable, those that who are not, you know, well buttressed. And my mother and I certainly would have fit that description. I was an out-of-work reporter with medical problems. I hadn't worked in a while. My mother was, you know, a retired person. We were easy picking.
Or so. And then there's, you know, the sick, the people that are young that don't have a support system. You can look at the single mothers that once they end up in jail, like say for a DUI, and then they're part of the system, that system, and they end up losing their children, and then it just cascades downward. So I understand what you mean by a person who's weakened and doesn't have the support system, then they become a target. They become, once they're part of that system, or in the system where they're constantly scrutinized by law enforcement, which is a misnomer because they're really not enforcing the law anymore.
No, they're like then, a private security force for the powers that be. They're not enforcing the law. You're right.
And they will enforce the law for the corporations, but they won't. They have ceased to be servants of the people. That is what they no longer are, in my humble opinion. So, and they're being used. They're being used, some of them, and they don't even know it. They're being used by the powers that be. Because when it comes right down to it, they're being abused. They're not paid enough. They're not trained adequately. And their thinking about what they're doing is completely skewed. Would you say I'm kind of on the right track with that?
Absolutely. Yes, I had an interesting conversation in Mexico. It was a couple of years ago. I was at that point living in Yucatan. I've since left and then living in the mountains of Chiapas now. But I was at an event where there were a lot of expats. And there was a man at the table, and we were chatting a bit, and he was saying he took early retirement. And I said, "Oh, what did you do?" And he said, "Oh, I was a police officer." I said, "Oh." He goes, "Well, what did you do?" I go, "Well, I'm a reporter." And he got this kind of spooky expression in his face. He goes, "You're a reporter." He goes, then you know what's going on. You know.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I go, "Yeah, actually, I think I do." So, you know, he bailed. I mean, he didn't want to be a part of it. And he took early retirement shortly after September 11th, this man did. But, you know, it to me, this particular little vignette sheds a bit of light on, you know, what is going on in terms of the thinking of people on the police force. They know something's going on that isn't what it's supposed to be. And some choose to stay and some choose to leave.
It's very frightening to think that we're kind of here, like we grow up with the feeling that, you know, we're part of the American way and we have the laws behind us and our culture and all of that has been broken down now. That none of that exists anymore. It's kind of the people who are in the know, the critical thinkers, the people who actually know what's going on, some of us are floundering. And I think we have the right idea with localism and growing our own food and developing our own networks. But beyond that, I think as far as the political situation goes and what the powers that be are doing, I think it's too late. Do you have that?
Well,
same?
I don't. I will never believe it's too late until it's clearly too late. And let me explain what I mean by that. My research and my experiences and my research after these events took place in my life has led me to the conclusion that we're cresting on another event. And the event is going to fold in, the demographic targeting, the targeting of, certain demographic groups, particularly, as I mentioned before, the vulnerable, but those aren't the only ones who I think are going to be targeted. I think that certain racial groups are going to be targeted as well. And I think that, folding in the demographic targeting into a pandemic level event where the pandemic could very well be selectively delivered. And a lot of the work that I've done as a journalist has been in terms of documenting what sorts of selective delivery systems are already in place. So the conclusions that I come to in exile are actually global. You start with a very tiny situation, which is what happens to a mother and a daughter in Southern California. And, why was a federal agent attached to this situation? What was it about this that turned everything into really a national security situation in terms of the responses by the system after I somehow miraculously survived that assault by the police? What is this really all about? And I have put together, I've connected dots in a way that I think is a bit unusual, possibly a bit out of the box. And I totally stand by my perceptions and my predictions in terms of exile. So that's kind of, in a nutshell of what I've tried to do, starting with a little situation, two people minding their own business, not bothering anybody, trying, really struggling to kind of keep it together, into what does this mean? The planet's become very small. We're obviously experiencing a global chessboard now. A lot of it is focusing on the Middle East, and how, what is this really all about? And I have
some conclusions. How much of the actual revolutions and uprisings in the different Middle Eastern countries, how much of them do you think are manufactured by the West?
We're certainly seeing that in Ukraine, aren't we?
Because it looks like we're backing the bad guys, not the good guys. And I love the way that started out with, hey, everybody support Pussy Riot, Pussy Riot's fighting for, the rights for women and just rights in general. And then they come right over to the U.S. and get their photo op with Hillary Clinton. So I was very surprised by that. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm backing the wrong revolution. And then I started to read about the Ukraine, and then I understood who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. But the thing is, there's really no good or bad. It's, you look at both sides.
I don't think there are any good guys here. I want to qualify that. When we talk about nation states, when we talk about political governments, I am not convinced at this point in time that there are any good guys. I think that governments have their own agendas, which don't necessarily involve the welfare of their citizens and their constituents. I think we've seen this very clearly in the United States. So
right.
I think if there are good guys, it's going to be people in the grassroots, people in the independent media, people who are forming groups attempting to address the sorts of abuses going on. I think that's where our hope lies. Our hope lies in us. Our hope doesn't lie in them.
Yeah, it's like Congressman Kucinich, when I worked with him, had said, you know, everything good comes from the bottom and goes to the top. It doesn't go from the top to the bottom. So that mm-hmm. makes a lot of sense. You know, we are our people. The people that are in our neighborhoods are the servants to other people. We are all helping. We're all in this together, and we're all helping one another. And a perfect example of that is what they've done in Detroit over the past several years. As their systems, you know, as their infrastructure is broken down, and their city has basically gone bankrupt, and so much of it was because of corruption, and, you know, people have risen up and formed their own amazingly sustainable communities. And, you know, they're turning, like, empty lots into community gardens, and, you know, they have mm-hmm. their own medical care. And they're not relying on the services which no longer exist through the city and the county. So it's really become a renaissance, you know, a renaissance. I can't think of another word for that. And you're actually going to have to come from us. We're not going to get it from them, definitely. They don't want us to thrive. Do you get that feeling?
I think that as far as some of us goes, they want us 6 feet under. And, you know, my real concern here is essentially that the country is booby-trapped now with biochem delivery systems, booby-trapped. And for those who don't know what I'm talking about, you can buy the book Exile, and you can also just go onto Google and Google water as a weapon, for starters. And I've written dozens of articles, you know, based on documentation that began with that particular article. So, you know, as long as they control, as long as they are intent on solidifying their power by getting rid of the demographic groups that they have decided need to go, then I think people living within the borders who are not aware of this and don't know how to protect themselves are really at risk. And this is not a doomsday message. You can survive this, but you have to know, you know, what the deal is and what the delivery systems are. And, you know,
and you
I believe that
if whoever controls the water is going to control the population, that's what it's going to come down.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And in the USA Patriot Act and following the USA Patriot Act and the Critical Infrastructure Information Protection Act of 2002, they made it a federal crime for government employees to release information about water systems. Did you know that? I mean, it became a federal crime. Now, why did they do that? What's so special about water systems that they have to, you know, make it a federal crime? Well, I found out because in the course of my making Public Records Act requests for water blueprints, I began to get a series from Los Angeles, city of Los Angeles, I was getting a series of redacted blueprints, stamped, every blueprint, stamped, redacted, that means information has been excised, right? Well, I had already gotten the real blueprints by hanging around street crews on the street and, you know, chatting them up and flirting, whatever I had to do, and then saying, hey, you know, can I see your blueprints? You know, and then I grab my little pocket camera and take pictures before their mouths would fall open in astonishment, right? So I had information concerning the blueprints that I was given, and what was redacted on the blueprints would be exactly the information that would reveal that there was the selectivity in terms of a delivery system. And once again, I think possibly your listening audience may not know what I'm talking about with this, and, you know, start with water as a weapon. You can Google it. And I got better pictures of blueprints with a subsequent article called Homeward Bound. And it's very clear. You look at the blueprints, it's very clear what they've done. And the information they redacted would have led people to believe they didn't do it. So, And then when you add that to the changes in the USA Patriot Act to our domestic biological weapons legislation, there were in Section 817, and once again, the listening audience can check this, Section 817 of the USA Patriot Act, they changed our existing biological weapons statute, and they added a caveat that says the prohibitions contained in this section shall not apply to any duly authorized United States governmental activity. Now, by doing that, they gave themselves a blank slate. I mean,
right.
We don't have to, but we don't have to abide by our biological weapons laws. And also, by doing that, they de facto violated the Biological Weapons Convention, which is the international
treaty.
With
that caveat, it's almost like they gave themselves permission to do whatever they want. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Whatever they
did.
Go ahead.
I just want to say, I think that also that, you know, they've given themselves permission now to transport, and I believe that we may have become the biological weapons dealer for the world now. They come to the U.S., you know, you can get it from us. Yeah, what were you going to say, Anita?
We have a caller. We're getting down to the last couple minutes, but I wanted to see if this caller had a question for you. So let me go ahead and zap them in and see if they have a question. Caller, you're on the line. Can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
My name is Marilyn, and I'm calling from California.
Hi, Marilyn. Have you got a question for Janet?
Well, I just wanted to have a couple of questions and a comment. I wanted to ask Janet, is she okay down there in Chiapas, or is she still having these stalking issues?
I'm having stalking issues. I've had a number of unauthorized accesses to my residence, and I have run into some chemical assassination weapons. I'm saying it. It's happened, and I'm very careful now. I am extremely careful. Not eating any, drinking from any open containers in the fridge. I'm living, you know, I'm walking on eggshells. But now that I kind of really have my sea legs into what they're actually doing in my situation and how, you know, how they're coming towards me, I think that I'm hanging pretty tough. So,
I just
thank
want
you for
to
asking.
Tell listeners that I, you know, Janet, I wanted to thank you for sending me your book. I'm the lady that asked you to send it.
Hi, Marilyn. Hi.
Yes.
Okay.
And, actually, I'm a microbiologist by trade, and I worked as a chemist in the oil industry, so I'm really interested in all these things that you found in your research. And there are things I didn't know specifically, but I had sort of wondered myself what's going on, because I noticed myself that certain kinds of food always made me very sick, and I have to walk on eggshells with everything I eat, so I sort of wonder if that's going on with me too. But I don't think I'm being stalked or anything like that, but everything that you've written I find fascinating. I do think there's a concerted effort to do away with about two-thirds of the population, and they're using all kinds of weapons, you know, to do it, food and water, radiation, wars. As a Christian, I think abortion is one. There's just all kinds of things they're using, and so I find it fascinating the things that you've come out with in your book, and I totally recommend your book to anybody that would buy it. It's a fascinating book.
I'm going to ask both of
you
a question. How do you all feel about the Agenda 21 question? Because when you speak about Agenda 21 to people, they even believe that's a conspiracy theory, even though it's written right on the UN's website in its entirety.
It's kind of a coordinated document, I think. I mean, I've worked on it for years. If you look at my website, I've been reading and working on it for about 15 years. So, it's just sort of the coordinating document. It's sustainability is the buzzword for control. Right, right. And what's your take on it, Janet?
Run the other way. You hear the word smart growth, smart bombs, anything with a preposition of smart, run as fast as you can because you're going to – they want smart technology to control us. And they use the AI movement.
I think one of the aspects of Agenda 21 is they're really trying to get people out of rural areas into city centers, concentrated, because that way they really have their maximum control. And I think that is certainly, you know, something that is very apparent now, and especially also here in the third world, because we have something called the RED program, which is part of the United Nations, which is one of their brilliant ideas for controlling climate change. And it involves going into the jungles and the forested areas in the third world and getting the residents under giving them documents to sign without explaining that they're actually sacrificing their rights to live on the land, and then getting them out of the land and into the cities. And what they do with the land then, once they've gotten, you know, a hold of the forest, is also very disturbing. So I can see this happening here, you know, in Mexico as well.
Well, I'm noticing that in just about every place, you know, like in so many states, there's either fracking, mountaintop removal. Here in my county, I didn't know this till the other day, there's 22 open blast sites where they're doing actively mining. I don't know what they can mine in Florida. I mean, there's not that much here, and what's under most of Florida is water, but yet they're blasting what's here. They're already fracking the Everglades. So it's almost like they don't want us in the countryside. They definitely want to destroy the water sources, and they don't want us to know what they're doing. So, and they're doing most of this in pretty rural areas, even though the fracking that's being done in the Everglades is 1,000 feet from residences. So
wow.
It's and contiguous to the Everglades and contiguous to the last Florida panther refuge, the last one left. These majestic animals are almost gone, yet they're going to destroy their environment and just kill them off. So I'm appalled by it all and wondering why I've been so sick lately, because they blast right across the street from me and had no idea that these chemicals are being emitted, nitrous oxide and much, much more. So, you know, this is happening in the rural areas, and that's definitely one of the reasons why they want us in the cities. And I really believe that the end users of all this energy are going to be the foreign markets, so it will increase the GNP of the United States, because they're telling us that in the ads. We're going to be the number one oil resource. We're going to be the number one, you know, natural gas resources. They're telling us this. So,
do you ladies believe that oil is, quote, unquote, fossil fuel, and there's a peak oil crisis? Do you believe that?
I'm not sure what I think. I think there's got to be a reason why all of a sudden they're, you know, if we're at peak oil, they're absolutely going crazy to try to get it, and they don't give a damn who they hurt. The planet, people, wildlife, whatever, it's almost like a desperate surge to get it out of the ground. What do you think, Janet?
I'm not sure. You know, I know that we were sort of tossed a bone, so to speak, about, the invasion of Iraq, you know, and some of these other oil-rich countries. You know, those who are concerned about all these invasions are being told, well, this is, you know, blood for oil. They're just going after the oil. And I think that may not be true. I think that, or it may only be partially true. I think that any event of the magnitude of, you know, of beginning a war is generally overdetermined, meaning that there are other tributaries that go in, and I think to some extent this oil frenzy may be a cover for something else. But I don't know enough to state that with utter conviction, that we don't have some sort of peak oil crisis. I suspect we don't. I suspect it has been manufactured to cover up our real motives, which I think are quite a bit less acceptable than, you know, a grab for resources.
What about conflict minerals?
Could I
about
the peak
yeah.
oil? Because I come from an oil family, actually, and I worked in the oil industry. I just suggest that you can go on YouTube and listen to either Edward Engdahl or Fletcher Prouty, and they talk about this whole scam about oil being a fossil fuel. And I think that is also part and parcel of this whole depopulation effort. That's a good cover story. And it's part of the demonization via the green movement and the move toward organics. You can't get any more sustainable or green, for that matter, than oil. Oil is the ultimate organic compound and the ultimate sustainable compound. That's why this is so, it's like the government, they tell you one thing, believe the opposite, believe me. Anyway, I'll just shut up.
That's really interesting.
It's interesting to learn more, and as I learn more about conflict minerals, like such as lithium that we use in our computers and cell phones, you know, I have to wonder, you know, that's most of what AFRICOM, the new command that's taking over Africa, whether their mission, because since so much of it is found there and mined there. So I have to wonder about that, and I don't have answers either because I simply don't have enough hours in the day to try to research all of it, and I'm just trying to take in a little at a time, and it's a lot to digest, even the little portions. So I'm looking at another thing that's coming out of Africa. We were talking about biologicals as weapons, and water being used as a weapon. The Ebola virus is in the news again, and a big article called Ebola's Deadly Spread, with a map in Africa of Africa showing the different strains and how the strains that are not deadly are the ones that are in the U.S. And again, I have to wonder, is this manufactured in a test tube, or is it, you know, is it as they
Jennifer
say it
Lake,
is on this?
On Polio Forever, she was interviewed by Jim Fetzer not long ago. I know Janet was interviewed, and she talks about polio, radiation, and all these manufactured diseases quite a bit on a recent Jim Fetzer interview. I just urge you to listen to it because it's very comprehensive, covers a lot of ground, and it overlaps with what goes on with what Janet's seeing.
Mm-hmm. What do you think
Ebola's
about
manufacturing?
Yeah, Ebola is like really, I mean, it's pretty deadly, and specific strains
yeah.
are like the Zaire strain is, you know, 79% average fatality rate just with that strain, according to this diagram. So, Janet, what do you think about that? Do you think this is just one illness that's being used as a weapon?
Well, what I saw that was of interest to me in the recent Ebola outbreak was statements that this was an entirely new strain. Well, you know, where did it come from? I'm concerned because it does appear to me that they're emptying out Africa. I mean, we've got AIDS, we've got, you know, we've got Ebola, we've got a lot. Oh, you know, the hypertension and diabetes now, which are, you know, silent killers, are absolutely skyrocketing in Africa. I did a story on this recently. I'm writing now for New Eastern Outlook, which is out of Moscow, and you can find that online as well.
It's linked on the blog post for anybody listening. You can go to the blog post for this show, and it's and the link to NEO journal-neo.org is there.
Right, right. Yeah, and just briefly, I mean, the article went into, how the escalating rates of diabetes and hypertension in people of color appear to have traced back to the biological and chemical warfare unit under the South African apartheid government. So, you know, there's lots of sickness being visited on Africa, and I, my perception, I mean, just bottom line, is I think we've got a lily white agenda going on, and I think that people of color are going to be having a lot of problems. I think that there are several demographic groups that are going to be having a lot of problems, the elderly and disabled, people of color, and I go into other issues, other groups as well when I discuss this in exile. So I think that it's a rearing up of a master race agenda. Yeah, sorry.
Just so people know, as a veteran myself and coming from a military family, and I'm also diabetic, but I do health care and I do home care for a lot of veterans as well, and I've worked with many and have actually taken some of them to file a claim or file their claims with the VA. And the first thing these veterans are asked when they're filing a claim if they have diabetes is, were you in Vietnam and were you exposed to Agent Orange? And they say yes. And every single time, it's the diabetes is connected to Agent Orange, which, of course, is manufactured by Monsanto. And it was used as a defoliant, and it was sprayed everywhere, and the tanks were moved, and there was probably not any kind of hazmat protective gear used. But my question, my big question on this is, according to the VA's own website, 24% of all veterans are diabetic, and the general population in the United States is at 8%. And I have asked the VA doctors and I've asked civilian doctors, why would that be?
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and this is right on the VA's own website is where those stats are. So my question is, when I went through the gauntlet in basic training where they shot me with 10 vaccines on each arm with an air gun, what were they giving me? So that's my big question. Because I have no way of knowing what they were giving me. And that could be a big reason why that stat is so high for veterans. So there you go. That's my exposed information for the day. And I doubt we'll ever find out. Well, I doubt we'll ever get the truth, because I think if people went back on my medical records, it's probably not even listed what those vaccines were. But everybody in my flight of 50 women had to go through that gauntlet. And I remember we went back into formation. Once we went through the gauntlet and got 10 shots in each arm and went back into our formation, there was a flight of 50 men on the left and a flight of 50 men on the right. And half of those guys were passing out and falling on the ground. And my training instructor was turning going, boy, I have some great women. Nobody's passing out. I've got some strong women. And I thought, wow, I guess that's supposed to be a good thing, but that we're not passing out. But obviously the men that were passing out had gotten... Yeah, terrifying, terrifying. And they do this to prisoners, too. The prisoners end up, prisoners in the military-industrial complex, prison-industrial complex, are subjugated to vaccines, and they don't know what they are.
There you go. So you can use
I'm going to have to sign off for now. I'm in a public computer room. As I mentioned, I live in the mountains. I don't have adequate internet up there, and the room is going to be closing.
But I want to thank Marilyn for joining us and offering her questions and her comments. That was great. And Janet, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It was. Can you tell people how to reach you, how to find you online, and how to order the book?
Yes. You can, my website is janetphelan.com, and Phelan is spelled P-H-E-L-A-N, and you can contact me through my website. There's an email Janet button, and I get those emails, as Marilyn will attest to, and respond to them. And the book is entitled Exile, and at this point in time, it's only available by ordering at thebookpatch.com. So you go to their website and go into their bookstore, Exile.
And the blog post does have your website link on it. So anybody who wants to go to wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com, you will find that link at the very bottom of the show description, and you can click in right there. And I'll put another link for the book, too, if people want to order the book, so they can go right to the link on BookPatch. But I want to thank you for joining us, and this was, we could probably talk for 3 more hours just on all of the information that we know. So we'll have to save it for another show soon. We'll talk again, and I want to thank everybody for listening. I'm going to close off by playing another Pretender song. Good night, Janet.
Good night, and thank you so much, Anita.
Okay, and this is the Pretenders, I Go to Sleep, and we'll see you all next week. And happy solstice, everybody.